Hey there, before we get to today's episode, I want to give a little update for something going on in Backlog Land. I did a guest appearance over on the Fun and Games podcast. That is fun in quotation marks, Fun and Games podcast. We did a retrospective on the Xbox 360. And in this episode today, you're going to hear some talk of some Xbox 360 games. So if you want to hear more dedicated conversation, head over to the Fun and Games podcast, and I'll throw a link down in the show notes so that you can easily find that. Also, on this month's edition of Tales from the Way Backlog, which is available over on Patreon, I am doing an episode about Ultima 1, which we talked about in this episode. I got the inspiration to go back and play Ultima 1 by talking with Felipe, so you can go over to Patreon at the $5 tier and higher. You get this bonus show where I go back and play old retro games to fill in those holes in my gaming history. And that leaves me just to thank the wonderful people who support the show on Patreon and make this all possible. So thank you to Chris Nelson, the Top 3 Podcast crew, Chris Copleen, Eric Guess, Rick Firestone, Nick Ficori, Jill, Jeff, formerly Jerf, Kieran, Soccer, ZNA, Cupcake, Kyle, Christian S., Matt, aka Stormageddon, JD, Doug Leaf, Jason Emery, Brian Skirsha, Randall, Jake Martin, Jenny E., and many more. Thank you all so much for your support. If you're listening and you'd like to be like them, you can head to patreon.com/realDaveJackson. And with all that being said, it is time to dive into CRPGs. Hello everybody, my name is Dave Jackson, and you're listening to Tales from the Backlog. This is a video games review podcast where normally I bring on a guest to bring a game out of the backlog, play it, and discuss. Today we're not doing that. We've got a discussion interview type episode for you today, and it's a really special one. So, back in 2022, I did an episode called Elden Ring for the From Software Newbie, where I chatted with a few people who had never been into From Software's games before about why that was the game of theirs that kind of broke out for them. And since Baldur's Gate 3 released, I've noticed a lot of the same sentiments about Baldur's Gate 3. People saying, I don't normally play CRPGs, but I've put 150 hours into Baldur's Gate 3. And I brought on a CRPG expert today to dig into why. My guest today literally wrote for and edited the book on CRPGs. The book is called The CRPG Book, and I'd like to welcome on the show Felipe Pepe. Welcome, Felipe.
Hello. Hi, Dave. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. I've been following your writing on Medium and your Twitter account for a long time, just because you post such informative posts about RPGs, obscure RPGs, stuff that people might not know about from uncommon countries, we'll say, and then, of course, commenting on the popular stuff too. So when I thought, I want to talk about an RPG, you were the perfect guest. So I'm really happy to have you on here.
Oh, thank you. And I'm sorry for all the shit posting on my Twitter as well, besides the informative stuff.
Oh, well, the information is good. Shit posting is always good. Yeah. So before we talk about the Baldur's Gate 3 specific stuff, I want to talk a little bit about your personal history with CRPGs and about the CRPG book project. This is not a sponsored episode. I downloaded the CRPG book PDF, and then I bought the physical version of the book because I really loved reading it. The book is beautiful. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your personal history and about that massive, massive project. So first of all, why don't you just tell me a little bit about how you got into gaming and why CRPGs are the thing that you've dedicated so much time to?
Okay, so this goes a way back, but I'm Brazilian and I first began gaming on an Amiga computer. which is something extremely rare in Brazil because they were banned in the country because of the military dictatorship. Mm-hmm. We had a thing like in the 80s where they were like, okay, we only want to use our own technology. Anything from outside is going to be banned. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't have foreign computers in the country. But my father like brought one anyway. And we had a few games. And I remember playing those games. And that's how like I got into gaming. So you always came from the side of computers, which is something very rare in Brazil. Usually we all grew up playing like consoles. Even if it was like the bootleg ones, we always grew up with consoles. But I love computer games. And I remember the first RPG that I played was Betrayal at Krondor, which is like a really traditional CRPG from 1992, I think. But it had a little problem that is everything was in English. And I didn't speak English, which is really difficult when you have a game that is fully like narrative focus. And it had things like word puzzles and stuff like this, which were like impossible for me to play. So I was fascinated by this game. It's very, especially as a child, it's a very like exciting idea because you have like, it was already kind of like open world in first person. It had like 3D graphics. You had these people in costumes with like animated FMV scenes. It was like a very whimsical kind of game, but I couldn't play it. I could only watch my father play. And so then I went to the other PC games. Like, okay, it was the early 90s. So you start playing like Doom, Castle Wolfenstein 3D. You start playing like, you know, Warcraft 2 and all those kind of Civilization. And my friends, they had the consoles. So we would then play like some Breath of Fire, some Chrono Trigger, which was all amazing. But at the same time, we were having a huge boom of tabletop RPGs at the time.
Yeah.
So let's say when I was like 10 years old, I loved GURPS. I was like super excited playing this kind of game, the D&D second edition, Vampire. And then I remember like very clearly reading a game magazine and it had an article about Fallout 1.
Ooh.
And it said like, oh, this game is completely different from any other like RPG like Breath of Fire or like Chrono Trigger because the character you create and the choices that you make will change the narrative. And the example that they gave is that if you had a very smart character, you could talk to the farmer, teach him about crop rotation, and that will like improve the life of people in the village and give you like a reward. And it's just like, just talking, but based on the choices and the character that you made.
Right.
For me, that was like completely mind blowing, you know, like it's something from tabletop gaming that I had never seen in an RPG before.
Right.
It's not something that you have in Chrono Trigger or Breath of Fire. And so I went and bought their game. And it was simply like mind-blowing. To this day, it's one of like top five games of my life, Fallout 1. And not only I got to experience it and get all those different iterations, but then I have a younger brother and he was also playing it. But because he's younger, he didn't know English at the time. I was already like more or less okay. So I could understand the quest of like, oh, like Fallout is kind of a simple game, like text-wise, it's not... Like, it would be impossible for me to play Disco Elysium at the time, but Fallout was okay. And but my brother couldn't understand English. So he played the entire game just killing every single character in the game. And for me, it was amazing that not only he could do that, but the game would, like, reply to this. So he, like, he had the karma, like, oh, you're the child killer. You're, like, vilified in every single city, you know. And he got a different ending because of this. When he saved the vault, he's the, you know, spoiler for a almost 25-year-old game, but if you have bad karma when you save the vault at the end and the vault dweller, the vault overseer tell you that you cannot stay on the vault anymore, if you have bad karma, you shoot him. That's like the last scene of the game. Like if you're like a good karma person, he say, go and you just leave and you like wander through the waste. If you're bad, you shoot him. And I saw this, I was like, this is insane. My brother simply played the game, killing everyone, and the game replies to this and have a different ending.
Yeah.
So from that moment, I was completely hooked on RPGs. I was like, okay, I want which other games do this?
Wow, that is starting gaming like in the deep end, really. Like, so how old were you when you played those first ones that you talked about?
So Fallout 1, I was about 12 years old, more or less.
Okay, yeah.
But the other one, I was like, let's say... Six, 8 years old, more or less, like still like very young. That's why like I couldn't understand anything. It was just like
right.
really cool. You explore a 3D world, the guys in costumes talk to you. I'm like, oh, what are they saying? It's like,
yeah, it's interesting. Like, I think that's a pretty, at least from my experience and my friends growing up playing games, you know, everyone got started playing Mario or fighting games. Or like for me, I liked the Power Rangers. So I had the Power Rangers game on the Game Gear and stuff like that. And then like probably the most complicated game I played in like my early childhood, you know, was like Ocarina of Time or something like that. But what you're talking about, like Fallout, is like leagues more complicated than something like that. So yeah, you were shaped and molded at an early age.
No, I was a huge nerd. Like the other game that I love at this age was Civilization 2.
Uh-huh.
And I was such a nerd that I don't know if you ever owned the actual game, but it came with a huge thick manual that explains like all the civilizations and everything. Mm-hmm. And I used that to write a report at school.
Nice.
Because it was like, okay, what is a monarchy? And it had like 2 pages explaining monarchy for some reason.
There you go.
And I was like, okay, I'm going to use the Civilization 2 manual to write an essay for school.
Yeah, probably more entertaining for you than your textbook, for sure.
Yeah, and we didn't have internet, so it's like, okay, what do I have here?
Yeah, yeah. I can go to the library, or I can just look at the game manual that I already have.
Yeah, much nicer.
Yeah. Cool. Like, so I had not really expected you to get in that early to CRPGs. Like for me personally, my first CRPG, I suppose, would be Morrowind when it was on the Xbox. And that was, I was probably 17 when I played that for the first time. And that like dominated my life for like 2 years. It was just go to school, go to work, play Morrowind. That's basically all I did. And then I kind of followed, I think Morrowind introduced a lot of people to console CRPGs like KOTOR and Mass Effect and stuff like that. And then I've recently in the last like 5 years gotten really big back into the genre because of Disco Elysium. Mostly that was the first one that really got me back in. And then the Divinity Original Sin series. And then I've actually gone back and played some of the older classics like Planescape Torment, Fallout 1 and 2 and stuff like that recently. But you've been in it the whole time. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's also a bit sad in a way because we had like a really bad time. Because like that time that you said was amazing, like Morrowind and then you have Neverwinter Nights, Arcanon, mm-hmm. all about like the early 2000s. But then like from, let's say, the mid, late 2000s to until you have, I don't know, 2012, 2015, when they say like the RPG Renaissance, also like with Divinity, this kind of game. We had so few games to play, like if you were like a hardcore like PC gamer, it was right. a very bad time to be like, yeah, very few options. Was a rough time.
Yeah, that's part of like why Baldur's Gate 3's success is really surprising to me. Like, not surprising because it's not a great, wonderful game. It was my favorite game from 2023. But like you said, like people weren't really making these games like 10 years ago, people had to do Kickstarters to make these. As long, if your name wasn't BioWare, you had to make a Kickstarter to make a game like this.
Yeah, it was like I was already like at this time, like online in forums talking about RPGs. And it was mm-hmm. like, you had BioWare and Bethesda. That's it. Yeah. All the rest was like, oh, let's say Piranha Bytes made Risen 1 and no one in the West cared about it. Like it was like, the mm-hmm. only people like in Germany and Poland were playing it, you know, it was a kind of, they would call like Eurojunk and no one would pay attention. So yeah, for me, it's also like really amazing. Personally, I think like as someone who like studied and did like this analysis, historical analysis of how the genre progresses, mm-hmm. I think the last few years are simply the best years in history for RPGs. I know some people will get angry when I say this because they prefer the early 90s or the late 2000s, but I think we never had so much variety because like
yeah.
in the let's say when you have like 1999, 2000, you had some fantastic games, probably like the biggest amount of classics in just 1-2 years that we have. Yeah. But the amount of variety and like options that you can choose, like if you want a tactical RPG, you have a tactical RPG. If you want an immersive scene, you have one. A roguelike, like every single genre, every single type of game, you can find something very good now. So I think this is really like unique.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always kind of have the sentiment that every year is the new best year to love video games because you can play all the stuff from the past. But like you said, there's so much variety of new stuff coming out that even if it's your job to play video games, you're still not going to be able to play all of the good stuff that comes out. And game making tools are so much more accessible now that anyone who, you know, is able to and has the drive to can kind of make the type of game that they want or like the take two or three things that they like from other games and mash them together and make their own thing. And, you know, CRPGs especially are pretty complex, but people are making it work and it's really cool to see.
Yeah, for me, it's crazy that like some of my favorite games from last year were made by like the classic CRPG made by one person.
It's like
crazy that this can be made. And also the second thing that I think it really helps is that we don't have that many, how to say, language barriers anymore. Mm-hmm. Because now, like, even if you want to play like a Chinese RPG, it's probably going to be on Steam in English. Mm-hmm. Or it's going to be on Steam in Chinese, but then you get a language patch or something like this.
Yeah.
So this is something that like was simply unimaginable like before.
Right.
No one in like 1995 was like, oh, there's a revolution in CRPGs going on in China. Have you played? Like, no, you didn't even know anyone who like went to China or spoke Chinese. So it's
right.
It's really much more connected, a much more diverse and interesting world of like video games.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's especially great for people whose first language is not English. I mean, I'm in a lucky position where like, you know, unless I want to dig into Chinese games or obscure Japanese games or something like that, like everything's made for me most of the time. So it's great that, you know, localization, people can make, you know, a translation patch if they want, even for old games that were never localized. That stuff is awesome. So I have a couple of questions here from a community member, Pieboy, who had some questions for you. Pieboy wants to know, since CRPGs have been around for a long time and changed quite a bit during that time and kind of, you know, branched out into many different subtypes, etc., asking if you have a favorite era or particular style of CRPG. Like Pieboy mentions the classic Ultima Adventure style or Blobbers or Infinity Engine or even modern stuff or first person. Lots of diverse stuff to pick from.
Well, that's a good question. I really like, it's a very niche thing, but there is a style of game that I think is my favorite. And it's very, I'm very sad because very few developers make this kind of game. It's not a popular style. Mm-hmm. But I really love when you had like first person exploration, like a Blobber, but not locked to a grid. So not something like, I like games like Wizardry and like Legend of Grimrock. I think they're fantastic. Mm-hmm. But when they began doing exactly that, but without being locked in a grid. So some examples, Wizardry 8. Might and Magic series 6, 7, and 8. And I think one of my personal favorites is Wizards and Warriors, which is all this is from like a certain era, let's say from about 1997 to 2001, when is like they were just getting good enough to do 3D that they were exploring with this and trying different things, but not good enough with 3D to do something like Neverwinter Nights. Because that was, I say, like the big shift for an RPGs. The moment they did Neverwinter Nights, everyone was like, okay, third-person camera. Same for like, Neverwinter Nights and Morrowind as well. Mm-hmm. When they do, okay, we can do 3D worlds. We don't have to do them in first-person anymore in that style. And like Morrowind fits on that too. But I like when they are a bit more, like Morrowind's one of my favorite games of all time, but I like when they are more focused on exploration and puzzle. I think this is one of my favorite things. Mm-hmm. That's why I like Wizard and Warrior so much, because it's a game entirely focused on exploring dungeons and finding the little secrets that are everywhere because you're very clever in exploring and there's a big focus on combat. I think the last classic that they did in this style is something like Arx Fatalis.
Oh yeah.
Which I'm very sad because it's that one game that no one talks about from what's their name? Sorry, the name of the company, the Ars Fatalis people. They did all those.
Oh, is it Arcane?
Yeah, Arcane. So Arcane did all these classics that everyone likes, and people love to praise the, oh my God, I'm terrible with names, the one that you play an assassin jumping around cities.
Dishonored, yeah.
Yeah, Dishonored. People talk all the time about Dishonored, they talk about Prey, but no one talks about Ars Fatalis, which I think, personally, I think is the best one that they did.
You know, I was so disappointed by Redfall that I bought Ars Fatalis on Steam. So if I play that, I know who I'm going to hit up to do an episode of the podcast about it. I'm a huge fan of Arcane, but like most people, I started with Dishonored, played Prey, Deathloop, you know, other basically everything they've done since Dishonored 1, but I think I should go back in time. That's a good recommendation.
Yeah, it's a really interesting RPG. It feels like a clash between generations, because it's someone trying to bring the Ultima 1 and 2, Ultima Underworld 1 and 2 into the Xbox. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting. Like, there's so much that you can do. There's so many, already like a mix of immersive sim and dungeon exploration. I really like it. It's a very unique type of game.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay. Gonna push that up the backlog for sure. another question from Pieboy here, kind of related to the first question, is since you, now we know that you grew up playing, we'll say early, in air quotes, early CRPGs, and you've obviously done a bunch of research about them for the book project, do you still really enjoy playing those old ones? Would you boot up Ultima 1 for an afternoon just for fun, or is it more of a historical interest at this point?
I think some of them really depends. So like, I'm not a very big Ultima fan. Uh-huh. Like for me, the Ultima series became like really interesting in Ultima Underworld.
Okay.
What they did like from 1 to even 7, I'm not a big fan of those games, but I am a huge Wizardry fan, like exploring dungeons. So Wizardry 1 is still a game that I play that I find extremely enjoyable. Dungeon Master. I think even, yeah, like going back to the 80s, I think Ultima Dungeon Master, Pools of Radiance is kind of like a bit like stretching a bit. But I still find those games like very enjoyable, especially when I'm finding them from places that I didn't know before. So when I was, we were talking like before the show began, I was exploring more like Chinese and Korean games, mm-hmm. finding Chinese games from like the early 90s for me was amazing, because it's the same ideas being explored like in a completely different cultural context.
Yeah.
And even like those games, like, okay, they have a lot of issues, but issues like UI and stuff like this that don't really bother me much. Mm-hmm. What I really dislike in old games, and that goes even to JRPGs, is the grinding. That bothers me way more than, let's say, a bad UI or having to emulate the Apple II and playing a game from 82. That doesn't bother me. It's kind of funny because there is this moment in the dawn of RPGs, like in the very early first half of the 80s, that the games are extremely experimental and they don't have a lot of grinding. Mm-hmm. So you can beat, like, let's say, Ultima 1. You can beat that game in 2 hours. So is even if they, like, let's say, they are more like as a historical artifact, they are so interesting to experience and they are so short that I think it's a very good experience. It's, the whole package is fun. If it lasted 20 hours, I would probably not play it. Mm-hmm. But as a short, like, historical and still very creative, like, if talking about Ultima 1, is a game that you start, like, exploring the open world and you end, like, fighting TIE fighters in space. Like, no game today has this kind of range. Even Baldur's Gate doesn't go, like, that wild.
Not quite to that level.
Yeah, and you experience that in, like, 2 hours. So it's still, like, a very interesting experience. I will still go back to them.
Cool.
Especially the dungeon crawlers, which are, like, my favorite kind of genre.
Nice. That's, something that I did not grow up playing games on PC. Dungeon crawlers are a huge, like, empty spot in my gaming history. I actually have a bonus series that I do for the people on Patreon where I go back and play older games to kind of fill in those holes in my you know, or what could have been my early gaming history. So you're naming some stuff that I should probably check out for that series.
Yeah, and they're great. Like, I'm not sure if they're great for streaming because visually they're not very interesting. Uh-huh. But in terms of content, it's like in 2 hours you play one of the first RPGs in history and you it goes wild. Like, oh, I found a lightsaber. Like, what?
Yeah, there's a From Software game that I'm interested in playing called Shadow Tower Abyss that kind of has a turn like that. I don't know if you've played that game before.
No, I like the Kingsfield series, but the Shadow Towers, I'm not big into horror games, so I gotcha. Just like play a bit, yeah.
Gotcha, yeah. I played Kingsfield 4 for the first time a couple years ago and really, really enjoyed that. The Shadow Tower has a similar thing where you start out at like, you know, fighting things with swords and then you find guns eventually and then it goes in a weird direction like that. Not quite TIE Fighters, that's something else. that's cool. It's always interesting, like, even with games and genres that you grew up with personally, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to enjoy going back to them decades later. You know, stuff from my childhood is the same way. Just because I have nostalgia for it doesn't mean that I will actually sit down and play it and have a good time now. So good to hear that some of those things still hold up for you in that way. So kind of like fast forward a little bit, like when the CRPG boom, as I'm terming it right now, happens, let's say like 10 years ago or something like that, we start to see people crowdfunding these games. Dragon Age Inquisition wins a Game of the Year, which I went back and checked. Kind of interesting, like it's not necessarily expected. I didn't play that game. I know a lot of people are, it's polarizing, we'll say.
Yeah, that's a good description, yeah.
Yeah, it's polarizing, but the fact that an RPG like that would win Game of the Year when it's typically more, you know, quote, prestige type stuff, was at least interesting to see. And then you have stuff like Divinity Original Sin and Pillars of Eternity and the Shadowrun games that come out. Just tell me, like, did you dive headfirst into all that stuff when it was, when it started booming like that?
Oh, yeah. Like, I think that was like a really interesting shift because I actually disagree with you a bit because I think for me, Dragon Age Inquisition winning was like super predictable.
Was it? Okay.
Because BioWare was like the king of RPGs, but also of AAA gaming. You know, everyone was on the hype of like the Mass Effect series and the Dragon Age. Yeah. And too. So I think that what's controversial is that like that game came out like 1 week before the awards, game of the year. And today is a game that people don't really talk much about it anymore. Like, I think its strongest point were the characters that like really stuck with some people. Mm-hmm. But in general, if you look at the great games of the great RPGs of the 2010s, I don't think people are going to list Dragon Age Inquisition like on the top. They're going to be like other titles. And like you said, for me, it was a very interesting period because we had like I mentioned before, we had basically no RPGs at the time. You were playing like either BioWare and Bethesda games, or if you were like really hardcore, you were into like some super obscure indies, like you were playing like the GeneForce games from Spiderweb, you were playing like Echelon, you would play, like you mentioned, Risen or like Two Worlds 2, you know, like these games like the Eurojunk from Europe, like they would mention. But that was it. Like, even games, like, let's say, no JRPG was being ported to PCs or was, like, even arriving to us. Stuff like, let's say, Dragon's Dogma and Dark Souls. You have to remember that Dark Souls only came to PC because we had all that pressure from software, to start porting those games to PC. They had, like, they did a petition and it took, like, 1 year to port, and it was a very bad port, and Durante had to make that patch so it would actually run on most computers. But you had that kind of thing going, but then, like you said, Kickstarter changed everything, and I think people really, nowadays, like, a lot of people got burned out from Kickstarter, and developers move out, like, Larian did not use Kickstarter to make Baldur's Gate 3, but I think, like, it's really hard to underestimate how much Kickstarter changed everything, not only for the big games, so like from Divinity is the obvious choice, Pillars of Eternity, but also the Pathfinder games, but especially for the smaller RPGs. There are so many small RPGs that we played around the time that came out, like Shadowrun, which like, I think especially the Dragonfall is considered like a classic, and it's not a game that like would have come out any other way. Even like very small games, like in 2012, I put this game on the book because I think it's very emblematic of the situation, which is one called Paper Sorcerer, which is like a first-person RPG inspired by Wizardry that came out in 2012, just as the big Kickstarter campaigns were starting. So this guy is like a lone developer. The guy by himself made the game before, even before the Double Fine Kickstarter. He did buy Kickstarter and he raised like $5,000. And that was enough for him to make an RPG by himself and release. And all the, let's say, the old school websites cover it because it was like one of the few options that we have. FTL as well, if you remember the that space roguelike game. Yeah. So you were having like this game's Legend of Grimrock. It was a big revival bought by, let's say, by Steam being more accessible, by game engines being more accessible, this kind of revolution, but also by Kickstarter. And it's really like a fantastic moment in history when you see this shift. And I was there, like I was, it's a thing that like people don't remember, but like Larian was very small and it was very obscure at the time. Like
they'd been around, like they've been making games, for a while. Yeah.
Like, I love Divinity, Divine Divinity, their first game. But in the 2010s, they did Divinity 2, Dragon Commander, no, Ego Dragonis. Which is the one that is like kind of like a janky action RPG that you can become a dragon. It was like very B-side RPG. And after that, they basically like, okay, no one talks about them. And then they did their Kickstarter. And they were so small that like on our forum, like on RPG Codex and RPG Watch, we were fundraising for them. And if you boot up Divinity Original Sin 1, the logos of the forums appear when you boot up the game. It's like, oh, thank you for the... So, like, this is the scale you're talking about. Like,
what
the company that now made Baldur's Gate was thanking, like, forum members and stuff like this when you boot the game because, oh, you gave us, like, $10,000 and that really helped. It's like, it's crazy.
Yeah, that's wild. And that's, like... So, when I think about the CRPGs that I've been kind of delving into, like, over the last 5 years or so as I've gotten... I guess, back into them, because I kind of followed the general trend where they started slowly shifting them from CRPGs to action console RPGs, and then just sometimes even just straight up action games like Mass Effect 3. And then I kind of left that for a while, and then stuff like Disco Elysium and Divinity Original Sin 1. And I tried Pillars of Eternity for a little bit. I had a hard time with it. I would like to try it again, but... games like that kind of like brought, you know, brought it to a certain level, you'd say. But I think you mentioned something like people would call, people who are in it would call Shadowrun Dragonfall like a classic of the genre. Same with, you know, if people really like Pillars of Eternity, but Pillars of Eternity didn't sell really well. And Pillars of Eternity 2 sold even worse than that did. Harebrain Schemes isn't making more Dragon Run games and stuff like that. So we kind of like had the genre resurge a little bit, but it didn't like break through into becoming game of the year for a while.
Yeah, I think that is like the genius of Baldur's Gate and the genius of like what Larian did so well. Because I agree with what you say, like when we had this revival, let's say like the early 2010s, it was very nostalgia driven. So like Pillars of Eternity was a game made for people who grew up with Baldur's Gate 1 and 2.
Yeah.
And like they were very open about this. It was funded by those people. It was for those people. So like if you're not used to like controlling six people in isometric view in real time, it's going to be a mess for you.
That it was a mess for me because of that. Yeah.
And same way with like other games, like let's say that were coming out around the same time. A good example, like Legend of Grimrock is the same. Legend of Grimrock like is based on the first-person blobber, which is a genre. It is actually like a historical anomaly. It's one of the few genres that died. like literally mm-hmm. died from around, like, let's say, even less, from around like 1998 to 2012, you didn't have a single game in this genre being made like by a big studio. It's like really like more than 10 years. And this is not, like, say, like a B-side. In the early 90s, these were the top sellers. Mm-hmm. Computer RPGs were games like Eye of the Beholder, like Anvil of Dawn, Ultima Underworld, even stuff like Descent to Under Mountain. Even, like, everyone was trying to make these games, and they were extremely popular. Daggerfall, what's the name? Stonekeep, which was, like, one of the biggest sellers of the 90s. That people basically forget about it because it's very cringe to go back to it.
Okay.
But, like, these were, like, the top sellers. This was what RPGs were in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And then 5 years later, the genre is dead, and you don't have a single game about this. Mm-hmm. 2012, you have that revival going back to those. So Wasteland 2 is the same. It's a very, like, it's made for people who grew up, like, with Fallout. Mm-hmm. And that's cool. Like, that is nice. But even for me, who is a person who grew up with those games, like, those games were being made for me. Like, I was the one funding those Kickstarter and playing those games for me. But they always had that vibe of, like, okay, I played this before. This is something that is not, this is not trying to be a fantastic game on its own. It's trying to be like a good copy of those older games. Mm. And I think what really sets apart some games like Divinity Original Sin 1 is that it's like, no, I want to be my own thing. So, like, I have a foot on the past. So, like, Original Sin 1 is, like, heavily inspired by Ultima, especially Ultima 7. Sven, like, the owner of Larian, is a fanatic about Ultima. I actually mm-hmm. contacted him and I asked him to write about the Ultima 7 for the book. He replied, but he was too busy making Divinity Original Sin 1 to help. Uh-huh. But he, like, was, like, super nice with me. And he was like, oh, I love this game. I wish I had time to write a review about it and everything. But that's a game that, like, okay, one foot in the past and one foot in the future. And then when they try to do things like, okay, we're going to add multiplayer and we're going to add, like, a bunch of things mm-hmm. that are not something that the other games have. Like, of course, like, Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 had multiplayer, but no one actually played them that way. Mm-hmm. So this one is like, okay, we have split screen, multiplayer, and that kind of, like, more reactive, more like D&D kind of stuff. I think that is what really defines and change things. And that is what really brings us into this kind of revolution, that you have this first step, which is like, okay, let's bring back what we were doing in the past, mm-hmm. which is like Pillars, Wasteland 2 and everything. And now I think we are in this moment when it's like, we have been for, I think, the last 3 years, more or less, that, okay, this is what we did in the past. How can we do this and bring it to today, like, get the best of the past and the best of today?
Yeah.
And I think Baldur's Gate is such a classic. It's going to be like this watershed moment because it's the game that nails it on the head. It's the perfect combination of everything from the past with all the advancements, and is even, like, very forward-looking in the way that it handles multiplayer and stuff like this. So I think mm-hmm. that is the key. This is why, like, even, let's say, I was enjoying those old-school RPGs, the Pillars of Eternity, but you weren't. But now you're enjoying Baldur's Gate. I think this is the key element of, like, making them accessible and modern and also, like, forward-looking and more interesting.
Yeah, part of it for me is real time with pause is just, like, I didn't grow up doing it. I have a really hard time with it, especially when there are complex rule sets and, you know, complex decisions being made every second during that. You know, I played Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 last year for the first time, getting ready for Baldur's Gate 3. I did podcast episodes about them. I had a very hard time with those because I didn't understand what was happening, and the game didn't try to teach me. And I know that back in the day it was sold with, you know, a tome of a manual to teach you how to play, but you buy the game on Switch, you don't get that manual. So I think part of the thing about stuff like Shadowrun, about Disco Elysium, Baldur's Gate 3, is that they are, like, they contain, like you said, the essence of those older games, but they're also trying to teach people how to play, and they're also, like, making their own thing for people to learn. as well. You know, Baldur's Gate 3 is based on modern D&D, but they did not kind of rest on their laurels and say, well, people who know 5th edition D&D, they're going to love this game, and people who don't know 5th edition can't play. Like, they didn't say that. They took a lot of effort. There's a lot of UI design that went into teaching people how to play, how to understand all these terms that, you know, if you don't play D&D, you look up and you're like, what the hell is a saving throw? What does that mean? But this game actually teaches you if you're willing to read. And I think that, like, that's a big part of why Baldur's Gate 3 broke through, is because it is a super complex game. There's a lot to learn. There's a lot to think about. A lot goes into your strategy, but they didn't sacrifice that to appeal to a bigger audience the way that, like, Knights of the Old Republic did. They kept it all, but they're like, no, we're going to put in tools to help you learn so you can understand this stuff.
Yeah, and just a little aside, what is really funny hearing about you is, like, every single thing that you mentioned just now, you could apply to Baldur's Gate 1. Because, and I think this is the key element, that, like, I saw a presentation by Josh Sawyer, which is, like, the developer who did, like, New Vegas and Pillars of Eternity.
Yeah.
For him, it was, like, very weird to see Divinity Original Sin 1 breaking, especially Divinity Original Sin 2, breaking all the knowledge that he built upon the industry. So Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 were, like, a huge hits at the time. They were, like, they sold, like, 1 million units and everything. It was, like, and they were this revolution. This is why it's so funny that this is happening again with Baldur's Gate 3, because these games were the revolution already. Real Time with Paws was the accessibility revolution of RPGs back in the 90s. Because before, they were all turn-based, and people think this is too complicated. I say, if you go back to the Goldbot series of, like, or something, even, like, even Fallout a bit. So let's say the face of D&D games in the 90s were especially SSI games, the famous Gold Box series, so Pool of Radiance, they're kind of games, like, very archaic in the sense that, like, but still the very same style of, like, you create a party of six characters, explore dungeons. Mm-hmm. It was top-down tactical turn-based combat, and you had to know the rule set. And people were like, okay, this does not work anymore in the world of, like, Doom, in the world of Warcraft and Starcraft. So what they did was that, like, they combined the old turn-based RPGs with Warcraft. And this is how you get Real Time with Paws. This is what, like, the developers from BioWare saying, like, look, we are trying to make this accessible. So now D&D plays like Warcraft, which was, like, the most popular thing at the time. And it was an explosion accessibility, because you don't have to, let's say, tell every single person in your party what to do. You just select everyone and right-click on the enemy.
Like,
in the low-level thing, you can do this. If you put on easy, you can play the entire game like this. Yeah. So Baldur's Gate 1 did this revolution. But now I think not only UI and or game-making knowledge, in a sense, evolved so much, but also people don't play RTS anymore. It's not, like, a very popular genre. Like, it's not the peak of popularity, like it was Warcraft 2, Age of Empires, Starcraft, and everything.
Yeah.
So now that became, like, weird, but turn-based combat done in, like, a controller with, like, modern UI is much more accessible. So it's really funny for me to see this going around. And I completely understand this is why that first wave of RPGs were so weird. Because it was people like Josh Scheuer who were like, okay, I grew up with this logic that a game, an RPG to be accessible has to be real time with pause. So I'm going to do this again. And then they see a game going fully turn-based and being more accessible and selling more. It's really weird. Like, I actually put, if you check the on the book, there's a direct quote from Josh Scheuer saying, okay, Divinity Original Sin 2 taught us that we're not in the 90s anymore, that we can do turn-based combat. And that is why, like, on Pillars of Eternity 2, they later added via patch the option for you to play the game in turn-based. And it's really like one of those moments that you're like, okay, the industry really changed.
Right. And interesting to me, at least, that other RPG makers, they think that turn-based combat is out now. Final Fantasy goes into a full action game and stuff like that, when, you know, we see that's not necessarily the case. That historical context is really funny for me. I didn't know that, so I'm glad you brought that up. It's interesting, like, if I list the CRPGs that I've had an easy, like, entry into and just, like, hit the ground running and play, they're basically all turn-based, or they don't have combat at all, in Disco Elysium's case. But Divinity Original Sin, the early Fallout games, like, those are weird and buggy, and they're very different, but they're turn-based, so I can at least sit and think about what I want to do. Stuff like that, really easy to get into, and the real-time with pause, unless it's something that's, like, incredibly simplified, like Knights of the Old Republic, was really hard for me to get into. So, yeah, very interesting context there. Do you have anything that really stuck out to you? Like, we've been texting back and forth about Baldur's Gate 3 the last several months when we've been planning this episode and stuff. You're in the middle of a playthrough right now. I beat the game a couple weeks ago. Is there anything that stands out to you that, like, you feel is one thing that you can pinpoint as to why we had this rise of other CRPGs, the Pillars of Eternity, the Divinity Original Sin series, etc., but they didn't break out into, like, the general population. They didn't top the Steam sales charts or break records for concurrent players on Steam. Baldur's Gate 3 did. So is there anything that sticks out to you as to why? Why was this game such a success, beside the fact that it's a very good game, you know?
For me, there's, like, three pillars to this.
Okay.
First is, like, the general rise of tabletop gaming. And, like, as a very popular thing with, like, especially the, you know, the whole thing of, like, watching YouTubers play and that kind of thing, wanting to get involved. And if you look any clip of people playing Baldur's Gate in multiplayer, it's that, basically. So people want that. And that is why it's so important and so genius that this game is so fun to play in multiplayer. Mm-hmm. And this, too, was like a process, because Divinity Original Sin 1 is not fun to play in multiplayer. It completely gets, like, the logic wrong. It tries to make like you're playing co-op, basically, but, like, there's only one protagonist. Like, it feels like more like older style of games, you know, like when you would play like this very old console games where, like, oh, you can fight everyone, just an action game, and you can press start and someone will help you, like almost like Gauntlet, of that kind of, like, style of games. Divinity Original Sin got the idea, the second one, understood that, like, oh, we should make them fight in the style of, like, should be conflict within the party. Each person playing the game should have, like, some sort of agency. Yeah. I think that's really what makes it interesting. So it tries first with things like, oh, everyone is kind of competing for the same position. I'm going to do this very tabletop thing of, like, oh, we have a cutscene, but each player is seeing a different cutscene. That kind of thing, I think, really brings up the idea of, like, oh, you are, let's say, you're playing the Red Prince and you want to help the dragon to get some information, but I'm playing a warrior and I want to kill the dragon to get, let's say, his scales to make an armor for me.
Yeah.
That kind of, like, struggle of conflict between the party, I think, is one of the core things. That, like, everyone playing this game has agency and can do something fun. Mm-hmm. And this fits perfectly with this, like, new popularity of tabletop RPGs.
Yeah.
I think that is one part which is genius. And no other RPG did this. Not only, like, no one did this well, no one did this at all. Like, Larian is the company that mastered this.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I had that as one of my kind of points, too, is that, like, you always heard about D&D, or at least I did. You always heard about it. But I didn't know anyone who played. Like, when I was in high school or when I was in college, I didn't really know anybody who played. And then, other than D&D, you have other tabletop RPGs that, like, were around, you know, like, but I didn't know anyone who played Shadowrun or Cyberpunk or Shadowrun's another one or anything like that. Like, I didn't know anybody. I'd never even heard of those. But the like pop culture appeal of D&D, I think, has risen. I saw it in Stranger Things, and like Stranger Things was a huge, huge deal. So people saw them playing. Like you said, like stuff like Critical Role is some of the most popular content on the internet. The pandemic kind of, you know, forced people to play games together in a different way. And there's a lot of ways to play these types of games at a distance from each other, which is essentially what, you know, Divinity Original Sin, Baldur's Gate 3, lots of people are playing these co-op, but they're not, it's not couch co-op the way it could have been. And like, they even made a D&D movie and stuff. So like the pop culture appeal and general acceptance and more people playing tabletop games with each other was definitely something I highlighted too.
Yeah. And going back on this is like playing, like I'm playing right now, Baldur's Gate 3 with three friends. Mm-hmm. So we have the full party of four people, and, we're playing the Dark Urge story. I'm playing the Dark Urge, and we're okay. just going like completely bonkers.
Yeah.
It feels like almost like playing Among Us sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Because it's like, oh, we should talk to this NPC. No, I just killed him.
Yep.
And it's such a fun, like, it's so funny that like not only the game lets you do this, the game reacts to this. And like there was one moment where like the party was trying to stop me from getting to an NPC to kill him. So mm-hmm. they were like, they were pushing me off the cliff, you know, like that kind of thing. I was trying to climb the cliff and one of them would just push me. And I was like, you killed me. And they're like, oh, we're waiting until we finish the quest. Then we're going to revive you.
Okay. Then you can come back. You can satisfy your dark urge.
Yeah. And like that kind of thing, like no other, like I wrote a book about RPG history. No other RPG in history did this.
Yeah.
I think the first one who actually nailed this was like Divinity Original Sin 2, but Baldur's Gate takes it to other levels.
Yeah. So
it's really like, I think people underestimate just how important this is, even if it's not everyone is playing multiplayer, of course.
Right.
But even watching people live stream themselves playing this game in multiplayer is huge and helps people mm-hmm. want to buy the game and play it as well.
Yeah. One of the community members named Dog Nozzle, who's a patron of the show, thank you, Dog Nozzle, says that it seems like they have seen way more people talking about playing Baldur's Gate 3 co-op than any other CRPG. I know Divinity Original Sin 2 had co-op because that's how they, Dog Nozzle, played it, but it feels so much less janky in Baldur's Gate 3. Like it was an important feature that they designed around rather than something they threw in as an afterthought. Between that and social media appeal, which we'll talk about in a second, Baldur's Gate 3 somehow feels less lonely than other CRPGs, which Dog Nozzle says is the ultimate genre for don't bother me, I'm locking myself in my room for the next 120 hours.
Yeah, and they were like simply, it was very rare to have any, like if you look in history, I think you can count like in one hand the number of like classic RPGs that actually support multiplayer.
Mm-hmm.
We had like a little moment in the early 90s when you had like some games that were like split screen that you were supposed to like both people sitting on the same computer play the game together. You had Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 had multiplayer, but again, like I played this with my brother. It was like we, like two brothers living on the same house.
Yeah.
We never even like left the first city because it was simply like a pain to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
The only real use for multiplayer in that game was that if you play multiplayer, you can create the whole party of custom characters
mm-hmm.
instead of like playing like one character and make and recruiting companions.
Yeah.
Baldur's Gate 1 didn't have a tool for you to create, let's say, like modern games like this time, like even Baldur's Gate has that you can play only custom characters.
Mm-hmm.
You had to go into multiplayer and do this. So I think that was like the only real benefit because they never got the tabletop thing right. You know, it's always one person is the main character and the other character is just there.
Yeah. 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 I don't play basically anything co-op unless it's a game that you have to play co-op. So I'm kind of on the outside looking at everybody else who's playing it co-op, but like, I don't hear anybody saying like, that playing Baldur's Gate 3 co-op is a chore or that it's janky or that it's broken or anything like that. the only thing that I hear is stuff like you were mentioning, where it's like, I'm playing with my friends. One of my friends just wants to create chaos. And so, like, worst case scenario, you miss some of the story because your Dark Urge friend keeps killing all the NPCs or something like that. But you're creating your own story when you have something like that. So it's not like you're breaking the game to a point where you can't play it.
Yeah, and that's just why the game is so brilliant, because like one of the jokes that we have is that like we have so many clutter in our inventory because we kill every single vendor. We don't have anyone to sell items to. And, you know, it just keeps like organically creating this kind of stories, which is the core of a good tabletop RPG section. Like I grew up playing those games. You know, it's something that like we were talking before, like Baldur's Gate is not a perfect game. There are some small details that you can complain about it. So like, I heard people saying that like, okay, the story when you close it is not as good and everything. It could be better. The whole thing is like, if you check tabletop modules, the stories that you play, they all have like very mediocre story. But no one remembers like, oh, I played this RPG session and we killed Astrala, the last king of the valley, and this made the peasants happy again. No. You remember that, like, oh, I was exploring a dungeon, like, this dumb thing happened because my friend was stupid. And this is the thing that, like, you know, this is what tabletop is built around, and this is what Baldur's Gate really understand, that, like, maybe the story that the game is presenting is kind of, like, okay. It's not bad. It's just, like, okay. What you're going to remember is all the dumb thing that you did all the way around. So, like, I was like, again, playing the Dark Urge, playing evil on the second chapter. I don't want to give like spoils, but like there is this evil guy that you can work for him. Or like usually players are going to betray him and kill him.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I want to see where this goes. So I just kept working from him. He kept asking me to do like the worst things for me. Like my ultimate goal was to kill him, but I was still helping him the entire chapter. And everyone was like, why are you doing this? I want to see where it goes. And of course, this screwed me up in the end. But we were just like trying and like seeing as pushing it as far as we could to see if the game would break or like what will happen. And this is like wonderful because other games don't let you do this. Like, which is like, let's say, what are the other big popular RPG series that we have? Something like Dragon's Age, especially Mass Effect, I think was the last. Mass Effect and Skyrim was the last, say, the big hits of popularity. You cannot go in Skyrim and kill Ulfric Stormking. He's not a killable NPC. You can attack him. He's going to say, don't do this again. Like, if you're playing Mass Effect, you cannot go into the council and shoot everyone because like they don't let you go full Spectre all around. Like, you cannot push the system any further. Like, it's very linear. It's very like on the rails. And Baldur's Gate 3 doesn't care. You can do like whatever. It's really magical. It reminds me, and this is where I see like a lot of the Ultima inspiration that Sven has in Larian. If you play Ultima 7, you can literally destroy the entire planet. There's a it's a little Easter egg, but there's a spell called Armageddon that destroys the entire planet, and you can cast it.
Okay.
And you can play like and the whole world is destroyed, and King Lord British goes to you like, why did you do this? Are you crazy? Like, you just destroyed the planet.
And like, you're like, I just wanted to see what would happen.
Yeah, and now I will reload. But like, you can do this. And, you know, it's something that is kind of like lost in modern RPGs. Like, you play a lot of Morrowind. You can kill everyone there. And the thread of prophecy is severed. But you can continue playing the game in this doom world. You know, it will let you do all the wacky stuff. Like, we were talking about, like, my brother played Fallout 1, killing every single NPC in the game. And then he killed the Overseer and the end of the game was like, yeah, this is your story.
Yeah.
This is the kind of thing that that would be like, let's say, the second pillar that like it brings all the complexity, not only in systems like, oh, you have all the classes and everything, but you have all the reactivity, the choices. You can do quests any dumb way that you want and the game's going to react to that, which is something that was completely removed in as games became more mainstream and more polished, you know?
Yeah.
As you play Mass Effect, it's like, are you good or evil? And that's it. You know, you can only be that. You cannot be like, oh, I'm going to be like smart and just steal this, or I'm going to just ignore them. So I think that's the second thing. Like, you have all the complexity of quests, of reactivity, of classes. And the third pillar that really makes Baldur's Gate is the presentation. Like,
yeah,
we have to talk about this. Like,
yeah,
it's something that, like, I think goes even further, like The Witcher 3, which was already like the, let's say, the high bar for the industry. It goes even further while still keeping the janky multiplayer the way you can do anything and all the reactivity. So it's really like, it's insane. Like, the more I play this game, the more I'm like completely like, my mind is blown away that a game like this exists, which is why I cannot imagine the anxiety that Sven and Larian has right now, because how do you follow up on this?
Right.
I have no idea how can they do something like this again.
Yeah, that's something that, like, I've been thinking about, and there's been, you know, some think pieces that people wrote where they were like, this sets a new bar that every RPG afterwards has to meet, and it's going to ruin RPGs forever. I'm like, no, it's not. Like, everyone, I think, if you love the game as much as the two of us do, like, you understand, like, this is a special product, but not that the next RPG that comes out doesn't have to be this again. Like, Larian's in an interesting situation because, like, that's their follow-up, right? But, like, the next, let's say Disco Elysium 2 comes out, they don't have to match Baldur's Gate 3. They need to do their own thing. And I think, like, people are going to calm down over time, but it is interesting to think about how Larian approaches it, because all the things that we've talked about, like the reactivity, the way that the game will proceed basically regardless of what you choose to do, you choose to kill everybody, kill every vendor, kill every quest giver, etc. Baldur's Gate 3 has an ending for that. It has a story for that, aside from the stories that you've created. But, like, that complexity with this level of polish is a rare, very difficult thing to do. So it's like, I don't think it's fair for people to expect this from every RPG going forward. Like, this is a labor of love. And I would not be surprised if Larian did something on a much smaller scale for the next game they did.
Yeah, like, for sure, I'm not worried about the industry in general, because, like, historically, it simply never happened that one big hit is followed by another big hit in the same style. Historically never happens. Like, if you have, like, let's say, you have Mass Effect being the huge hit, then, which is like a linear, party-based, cinematic adventure. The next one is Skyrim, which is like the complete opposite. It's like, oh, this open world, super easy exploration game. And the next one is Dark Souls, which is like, okay, we're going to, like, smaller scale and going super hardcore. If you think about, like, say, the peaks of the RPG genre, they completely keep changing. And then from Dark Souls, you go to, like, The Witcher 3. So it's like completely keeps changing. It's never the same thing. But for the same company, I think that's a bit tricky, because then you'll have something like, let's say, Mass Effect 1, 2, 3, or Dragon Age 1, Origins 2, and Inquisition. That's a bit tricky, because that's the game that you are making.
Yeah.
And let's say Divinity Original Sin 1, 2, and Baldur's Gate 3 are the kind of evolution.
Yeah.
Of course, what came before is completely different. Like, there's basically nothing connecting, really, Divinity to Echo Draconis to Original Sin. Like, it's the same setting. It's the same villains. Like, you, I wonder how many people even understand the lore, because you have to play, like, basically all those games. Like, Original Sin 2 is like the ending of the game is a reference to Divine Divinity, which is a game from 2001 to like 100 people playing. I think YouTube videos made a lot of like heavy lifting about the lore and everything. But yeah, I don't think it's going to, like, the next big game is not going to be Baldur's Gate 4. It's going to be something completely different.
Yeah.
Maybe Dragon's Dogma 2. I hope so. But
I hope,
like,
so. Yeah.
But I think it's going to be something completely different that, let's say, learns from Baldur's Gate 3. I think the big legacy of Baldur's Gate 3 is the multiplayer. That is what I expect, that, let's say, the poor people at BioWare right now are like, how can we put multiplayer into the next Dragon Age or the next Mass Effect? But I don't expect anyone to be trying to be like, oh, we're going to do the next big Baldur's Gate outside of Larian.
Yeah, I think cooler heads will prevail from people who are making decisions about that. Because it's frankly, it's an insane thing for everyone to expect everyone to do. The presentation, I think, is a good shout out for Baldur's Gate 3. And it's not like there haven't been, like, quote, modern looking CRPGs recently or out there, but I think that like when you are thinking about why it hit such a mass appeal, like you do have the isometric view, but you don't have to have the isometric view. You can move the camera around however you want in that game. When you talk to all the characters, and Baldur's Gate 3 has so much dialogue, so much voice acting, the characters are right in front of you. Like you mentioned, The Witcher 3, very similar to that. And that presentation kind of, I think, helps sell the performances. Like people get really attached to the characters in Baldur's Gate 3. And that presentation of the characters or important story moments with certain characters, thinking of like my favorite endings for certain character quests, like that all takes place with a more cinematic focus or a more cinematic presentation than the big climactic moments in Disco Elysium do. And that's a recent game. But that stuff takes place mostly through just text and listening to the voices. And you see what's happening, but you're very zoomed out from it. Not that it's any less impactful because of that, but if someone's just watching a stream, for example, then they're maybe not going to pick up on, or they're maybe not going to connect in that same way. So yeah, the presentation was a good shout.
Yeah, and I think a lot about the presentation because of games like Pathfinder, which mm-hmm. I don't know if you play them. Like
I haven't.
So Pathfinder, especially the last one, Wrath of the Righteous,
yeah,
is basically the same game as Baldur's Gate 3, like in the sense of like mechanics. It's the same level of complexity. In some ways, it even goes even further. Mm-hmm. Like the amount of options of like narrative choices and the activity that you have in that game is absolutely insane. Mm-hmm. Like by the end of the game, you can either like, let's say, be like a holy creature, raising armies to fight the devils, like armies of angels, and like everyone is super holy, and you are actually like a divine creature with special powers fighting against the armies of demons. Or you can be an actual lich, and everyone in your party you kill and you raise them as an undead. Like, you can play all this. Like, it's insane how much options and how much depth, and like the character creation of that game is like 10 times more complex than Baldur's Gates.
Yep.
And like, You can play as a little, let's say, you can play as what's the legal name of the hobbit?
A like halfling? A halfling, yeah.
Yeah, you can play as a halfling that is like a knight that rides on a triceratops into battle.
That's one of the members of our community, Zolgeek, was talking about. Zolgeek is a serial character creator, and then like play a couple hours and then make a new character. And he's been talking about all of these just wild, creative characters that you can make in that game. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it is fantastic, but it is an old school isometric presentation.
Yeah.
So like even as I'm playing, I was like, I really wish this would like zoom in like, oh, you became a lich. And you like you see like your little sprite on the screen, like you have a nice picture and everything, but like it's in your mind, which is really cool. But sometimes even like to show to your friends, like, oh, like let's say I wish I could like record a clip of myself turning to a lich that is not like, let's say, a super far away view of isometric characters talking to each other, you know? Mm-hmm. That thing really brings things to the next level. And it's not something that I can ask the Pathfinder developers to do. It's like, oh, why don't you spend like $200 million making this cinematic? It's like, which is the whole thing that like, when we were discussing this kind of games, like when we were talking about this before, when RPG started to go mainstream and especially shifting to consoles, so like when you have like Mass Effect, when you had the first Dragon Age hitting, we would always ask people, like, why can we not have a bit more depth? Why do they have to be, like, streamlined? And I remember this conversation with a developer who said, like, you cannot have a faithful recreation of tabletop D&D in an RPG. Because what happens, like, let's say, you're fighting a dragon and you use a grapple attack. I'm going to have to create the animation of your character grappling a dragon.
Yeah.
And this is something like, and what if the character is small? What if you are grappling, like, let's say, a creature that is like an object, like you're crafting a ram or something like this? This was like simply like, they would say, this is impossible. You cannot make this level of reactivity and animation. Mm-hmm. And then Baldur's Gate goes and does it.
Yeah.
Of course, they expend like absurd amount of money to make this.
Yeah.
That's why we cannot expect any other studio to do this.
Like, right.
Maybe like only Bethesda and BioWare can do this, and BioWare are not even sure that EA would give them that much money.
Right.
But like, that is what is so mind-blowing. They're like, they did what they... People always told us this is impossible. This is why roguelikes exist. Because roguelikes, your character is like a little letter. So mm-hmm. I can put on text anything. This character grappled the other, rolls on the mud, and lose his weapon. Yeah. I can do this because it's just text. If I had to animate this with all the variation of classes, races, and everything, it would cost like millions just to do like one animation. So,
Yeah, the development situation is unique, we'll say. They had the budget, yeah, for sure. They had the early access period to work on all of this stuff, to fix it all up and get feedback and all of that. Not something you can expect of other
and
people.
And the main thing is like they wanted to do this. It was important to them. Like them themselves, they're very passionate about this. Like if you talk to Swam is absolutely like, he loves RPGs and he wanted to do this. I interviewed him like almost like 10 years ago, mm-hmm. before like even the original Sins, and he was already talking about like, oh, I want to make like, I'm been building this company for like 10 years to make the one big RPG of my dreams.
Yeah.
And like, he always wanted this. So like, those things are there, not because like they make business sense, but because mm-hmm. they're very cool.
Yeah.
And because they're cool, we also think they're cool. And like, in the end, it ends up making business sense. But let's say if this went through like a normal company, a normal producer checking like, oh, this is not worth the expenses.
Right.
You could probably like save like 30% of the budget of the game and most people will not notice, but then it would not be such of like a passionate project, you know, like
yeah.
the people who are really like those little moments that really make you like absolutely love the game, the little like sparks of reactivity that are just like made for like 0.0001% of players. But anyone who sees this is going to love the game.
Yeah.
That is, I think, is what really like unrivaled.
Yeah. It's, you know, they always say that to creators, that if you're able to make things that you want, make something that you would like, not what you think other people would like. And that's going to lead to a better product. And I think that that's a good, sentiment for Baldur's Gate and for Larian, for sure. There is one other thing about Baldur's Gate 3's kind of breakout that I want to bring up, and it's something that people in the community brought up, which is social media and shareability and memeability, we'll say. Snacktaku, who's one of our patrons, thank you, Snacktaku, says, I think Baldur's Gate 3 was so successful because of social media and word of mouth, and also because it's a massively polished game. Snacktaku doesn't think it's because of interest growing in D&D as a whole, because that's stayed pretty consistent for a while now. And then Jake, who's a patron from the Pre-Order Bonus podcast, good show, former guest on this show, says, I agree about the word of mouth. Baldur's Gate 3 reached well beyond what most games do. My, quote, casual gamer, end quote, friends, who mostly play Call of Duty and Fortnite were asking me about Baldur's Gate 3 and if I'd heard of it. And I don't believe Larian's marketing push was anywhere near trying to compete with those big dogs in gaming. Something else bridged the gap. And then last but not least, Adam from the Respawn Aim Fire podcast says, not even joking here, wasn't that massive spike in Google searches lined up with the bear sex reveal? So I think that there is a massive part of this that is like going back to the reactivity and the complexity of everything that you can do. All of those things make for interesting clips that you can share or that you can watch on Twitch and then go tell people about and say like, hey, I was playing Baldur's Gate 3. My character turned into a bear. And then we had sexy time with my, companion character and it was a bear or something like that. Like these things that I feel like in Baldur's Gate happen naturally. Like I played the entire game, not even going to pretend I saw all the content because it's not that kind of game, but I played the whole game and there are very few times when I saw something and was like, they put that in there because it's going to make a fun screenshot or clip for people to send to other people. Like all of the things that I was like, this ridiculous thing happened, I need to show people, all came up naturally. You know what I mean? And then social media and shareability plays a big part in spreading the word.
Yeah, for sure. Like, we're seeing something very similar right now, which is Ball World.
That's right, yeah.
Which is just like this huge hit because everyone's like, oh, Pokemon with guns. And like,
right.
This is cool. And like, not only this, but like all the little things, like you can capture humans with your Pokeballs. And like,
yeah,
this is cool. And like, I think, and this is like a very personal opinion of mine, that like over time, the industry became like so formalized and mm-hmm. so stuck to some, let's say, ideas of like gameplay and stuff like this. So like games like, let's say, God of War, which is like, is an amazing game, but is a very like predictable game.
Yeah.
Everything weird about this is going to either come like from a story twist or something like this. And this is like, I'm sorry to say, we're basically the same age, I think.
Mm-hmm.
This is starting to become like boomer game.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we have an entire generation of people who are growing up with Roblox, with Minecraft, with like this kind of like way more chaotic kind of game.
Yeah.
Which is what we grew up as well, like when we were playing Flash games. Like,
yeah, right.
If you were on Newsground, like
on Newgrounds,
you would play something like, let's say, Sonic Final Fantasy X.
Yeah.
Or like, this is the story of like, I remember there was an RPG that I really like called like Epic Battle Saga or something like this. And the final boss was a zombie Goku from Dragon Ball. And like, yeah, I want to fight zombie Goku. And
of
like,
course.
It's cool. Like, I think when we go so much into like the industry, the professional side of stuff and everything, we forget how cool those things are and how sometimes you just want to see that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, Paul Well does this intentionally. He's trying to be like a parody and trying to be very popular and he's very successful at this. But Baldur's Gate 3 does this like organically. It's just like, you can do like weird shit. Like the previous games had this thing where like you can wear a bucket as a helmet. And it's like a little silly things. Mm-hmm. But there are so many silly things like this that you can do in Baldur's Gate 3. Like, you can literally like stack crates to jump over a wall and stuff like this, or push your friends over the, like, all these kind of things are so fun and so interesting. They're like, of course, they're going to become like you said, organically become memes and things that you want to share. And I think I like that the industry sees this and like, oh, maybe my game should have things like this as well, instead of being like so narrative, you know, especially these kind of things that come from Sony. They're like Uncharted, God of War, The Last of Us. They're like, everyone has exactly the same screenshot. Everyone has exactly the same experience, because what is interesting is not what is happening in gameplay, is mm-hmm. what is the game is showing to every single person, you know? So personally, I'm very much way more interested in the chaos in the games that are like Flash games, like early MMOs. There are games like, which is kind of why I like exploring. We were talking before, I like exploring games from outside the industry. So like, let's check mm-hmm. what China is doing. Let's check what Korea is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's check what like, a favorite of mine is like what people are doing in Tibia, which is like a free MMO from the 2000s that they converted into a free game engine. And they keep making free online MMOs. Like, oh, this is the Naruto MMO.
Uh-huh.
And you can go and play the Naruto MMO. And like, I like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people also really enjoy that. Sometimes you don't want a movie, you want a game. And Paul World and also Baldur's Gate lands on this. And I think it's a really cool stuff that we have things like this coming, not only from Roblox, but also from, let's say, one of the biggest budget games of the decade.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that like that kind of organic chaos is part of the draw to CRPGs in the first place. Like, any game that's trying to emulate that feel of a tabletop session, that's part of it. Like you said, with your, you know, your co-op playthrough with the Dark Urge, like that is capturing that same essence. So it's, yeah, no surprise that that is something that, you know, some people might experience in tabletop with their friends, but also experience that same level of chaos and memorable moments and things in Baldur's Gate 3. Like, I finished my playthrough of Baldur's Gate 3. I just like get this feeling with so like I do a different game every week on the podcast, and I take pretty extensive notes while I'm playing them, because I will just forget so many things. But Baldur's Gate was one where I was very confident when I was playing it, where I was like, I don't need to take notes. All I need to do is look at the quest log. I'll remember exactly how this played out because it's so memorable. Everything that happens is so memorable.
Yeah, like I lost an eye in one of the quests in the game. I lost an eye. I don't know if you
Oh, yeah, I did that.
Yeah, and like a few regrets, but then it's funny that like every single cutscene, I'm like, oh yeah, I lost an eye because you keep seeing there. So it, it's really another game that does this well that reminds me is the Zelda Tears of the Kingdom.
Yeah,
but like of course. For a month, everyone was just sharing how they were making like a Megazord with the I make like a helicopter and I'm carpet bombing all the goblins. You know? That kind of thing is like I really miss that more in games, and I think it's really cool that we're moving away from, because if you think like on the, I don't want to be too harsh on the early on 2000s RPGs, but if you go back to BioWare and Bethesda, like what were the equivalent? What were the shareable clips? And it's like in Fallout 3, like Inuka City. And that's what everyone was talking about. Oh, you can choose to nuke or to not to nuke a city. And this is a moral choice. I'm like, that is not a moral choice. Mass Effect has the similar one where it's like,
do you punch the reporter?
Yeah, exactly. You know exactly what I was going to say.
Yep.
Because that is, you know, we're talking Baldur's Gate about how like you can have sex with a bear or how you can lose your eye. And Mass Effect's like, oh, you can punch the report. And it's you know, going back, it falls like really flat. At the time, it was like you had this whole context and it was like, in a sense, they were the best that we had at the time. But that's why I think it was a kind of like a dark time, because we had like very little options and the options were a very specific kind of game. Well, now you can have like, you can carpet bomb the goblins, you can have sex with a bear, you can have all these weird things. And I think that's, we're much better for this. That's what I was mentioning before. Like, I think this is the best moment, because if you want to play the cinematic game, you also have those, you know?
Yeah.
You can be playing like Cyberpunk now, which everyone says like is amazing after the patches. And it goes much more into this kind of like Bethesda, BioWare kind of vibes. It's like, I think it's more faithful to the 2010 vibes of RPGs than something like Baldur's Gate.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that for sure. I'm playing Cyberpunk right now, actually. And yeah, I don't get the same kind of like, my choices have consequences, or I create these incredible organic moments the same way.
Yeah, I really wish playing that game, that, like you have all these implants and everything. I sometimes just wish instead of driving a car or a bike, I could be like running, jumping across the buildings or some like Spider-Man kind of stuff, but it's not that kind of game, you know?
Right, right. So going forward, we've talked about all these amazing things about Baldur's Gate 3. We've talked a little bit about the history of CRPGs, or at least our own personal history with the genre. So going forward, my hope, because Baldur's Gate 3 is such a huge success, that the interest, once people are finished and finish replaying the game, maybe a second or third time or whatever, my hope is that some of that interest will trickle backwards into history, into the other games that never got that same light shown on them. So I would like to get some recommendations throughout history from the different decades, we'll say, starting with the 80s. So we'll get one from the 80s, one from the 90s, the 2000s, 2010s, and then more recently, the 2020s. And each of us will give a recommendation for everybody here. We'll do these lightning round style. But if people liked Baldur's Gate 3, what else should they try? Where should they go from here? So we'll start with the 80s.
Okay, so the most obvious recommendation would be the Gold Box series, which were the Dungeons & Dragons games from the 80s. Like, and they're like really good games. One of them, like the first series, is a quadrology, like four games in a series that you import your character from one game to the other. And it's done like really well. You start like fighting goblins and everything, and you end like traveling the plains with Elminster and like defeating gods and stuff like this. But it's a game from 1988 that never got like a remaster. So I don't think it's a good entry point. If you want to play a game from the 80s, an RPG, I would rather recommend Wasteland Remastered.
Okay.
Because Wasteland was one of the first RPGs that like introduced the idea of like choices and consequences in a way that like, oh, you, and especially with gray morality, not always is obvious what you should do. Like, should you, like if an enemy has a hostage, should you let him kill the hostage and escape, and but like kill him? Should you let him escape? What should you do? So like, it makes a bunch of interesting questions. And it got a remaster like 2 years ago that I think does a very good job of like keeping it faithful to the original while also making more accessible. So like if you're coming from Baldur's Gate and you jump into a game from the 80s, it's going to be a shock no matter what you choose. I think Wasteland Remastered is like the closest thing you can get to like an accessible UI and like a more easy to get into experience.
Nice. Yeah, that's famously one of the games that inspired the Fallout series, right?
Yeah, and it has like a lot of the same vibes, like a weird wasteland, turn-based combat, and you a bunch of like moral choices and interesting things for you to do. And like it gets completely wild. Like there's a moment where like you're traveling inside the brain of an AI and stuff like this. So like really interesting game. Very dated in the sense of like its humor and reference, but I think now it is so dated that it adds to the charm, you know? Like,
yeah, yeah. I'm going to sit out the 80s because I was reading through the book, looking at all the options, and I was like, I've never played any of these, so I have nothing to contribute here. But now I have some stuff that we've... I've got some new tabs open on the browser for new games to go check out from that more distant history. Moving into the 90s, and you know, you said Wasteland, so my pick for the 90s was Fallout 2. I played this a couple years ago. It still holds up. It's got some like stuff where it's like if they made it today, they would program like the AI better and stuff, so you, like your companions don't shred you if you give them an assault rifle. They won't destroy you with that if they made it today. But it's still a game that I think offers a lot of like the choice in character building and choice in how you want to role play that, like, if you liked Baldur's Gate 3, you probably liked that aspect of it. So Fallout 2 is quite old in a lot of ways, but offers that, like you mentioned before, like the appeal of if I play a high intelligence character, then I will talk to people differently than a low intelligence character will. And Fallout's pretty famous for that. I had a good time playing it. I enjoyed the combat for the most part. It's turn-based, so it's, again, for someone like me, not as hard to jump right into. And the story's fun. The characters are memorable. Like, I had a good time with it. So that's my pick from the 90s.
Yeah, I think it's a great pick. Like, still one of my favorite games. I like Fallout 1 a tiny little bit more, but like, I think it's a question of taste. And also, like, I like the way it introduces the world more. It's for sure, it's like, let's say, it plays a bit worse, but I think the atmosphere of the first one is a bit more exciting, you know, like the way you see a Deathclaw for the first time in your life and that kind of stuff. But yeah, the second one is a fantastic game.
Yeah, yeah. And I also played Fallout 1 for the first time a couple months before I played Fallout 2. And I had a game-breaking bug that like fucked up the main quest. But before that happened, I was having a good time. So like, it's not like Fallout 2 is terrible or Fallout 1's terrible and Fallout 2 is great. Like they're both good.
Yeah. Okay. So from my 90s, I'm going to go with an obvious one, which is Planescape Torment.
Yeah.
Which is like, it is a classic. It's one of the best written RPGs of all time. And I think it plays on the same engine as Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. So it has the same thing of like the real time with pause that I know not everyone enjoys. This is a game that like, if you want, you can, the combat is the least important part of it. You can just play everything on easy, and I don't think it's an issue. I really recommend you playing a mage with high intelligence so you get extra dialogue choices, because the whole core of the game is you're exploring this completely wild and fascinating world of like the city of doors, Sigil. Mm-hmm. And it's a weird setting, extremely interesting. You feel like a stranger in a strange land with really fascinating companions. Like if you like the companions in Baldur's Gate 3, you're going to love the ones in Planescape, because it's also like a very weird group of weirdos, each of them with very personal stories. Mm-hmm. And it's just a fantastic game to play through, you know, and experience the story of like you, the nameless one, this character that like is immortal, and how the game plays with this. Like there's a dungeon that requires you to die to progress. So, you know, it's really like a fascinating experience. And you also got a remaster. You can play like even on tablet, and people say that like it's a very good experience on tablet actually. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is for sure like of the 90s, I think one of the easiest recommendations from people.
Yeah. Yeah, I love Planescape Torment. I played it, again, for the first time, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And it was after I played Disco Elysium, and I read that they were inspired by Planescape Torment. So I was like, oh, shit, I got to play that. And it's on Switch, so I played it on Switch. Like you said, play on easy, just enjoy the story. If you liked Baldur's Gate 3 for the writing and the characters and like the story, Planescape Torment's got that. It's got some of the best writing and like story, what you learn about your character, because it's an amnesiac character. It's an immortal character. An immortal amnesiac is an interesting combination, we'll say. So what you learn about your character, and the side characters are great too. Like what you learn about them is fantastic.
And a little aside here, as a historical curiosity, Planescape Torment came out just a bit after Final Fantasy VII. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those games where you really feel the... People usually talk about this. They're like, oh, Western RPGs and Japanese RPGs are completely different. Planescape Torment is an RPG heavily inspired by Final Fantasy. Mm. To the point that not only they have summon animations in battle. I don't know if you ever use one of those. Uh-huh. Like they have things like you can summon an army of angels. And it's exactly like Final Fantasy. The screen goes to the side and you have like a 30-second animation of a summon battle. Mm-hmm. But also on the credits, they specifically list like, oh, thank you Final Fantasy for the inspiration.
Nice. That's awesome.
So I always like to point that out for people who are like, oh, too hardcore to enjoy JRPGs. They're like, one of the top CRPGs of all time is like, thank you Final Fantasy.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. I didn't know that. My pick moving into the 2000s, I'm sticking with Baldur's Gate 2 for my pick for the 2000s. And I only wrote Baldur's Gate 2 because I couldn't write, you know what? Fuck it. It's my podcast. For my pick for the 2000s is to play Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. I'm one of the people who, having played them both, you can start with Baldur's Gate 2 and ignore 1, but I think bringing one character through both games and through that giant adventure, starting with killing rats in a basement all the way to, you know, facing the god of murder and even beyond that in the Throne of Baal expansion. It's a really cool experience to do that. The characters are fun. Like the gameplay gave me issues, as I talked about in those podcast episodes, but you can play it on story mode. Just enjoy dungeon crawling, enjoy picking up a bunch of loot, enjoy the quests. The creativity is really, really good with the quests in those games. So, I mean, obviously, if you like Baldur's Gate 3, why not try the earlier ones for my pick? And you will recognize some names from characters and things that are referenced in Baldur's Gate 3 come from those earlier games. So if you don't have that context, going back and seeing it would be cool.
Especially if you're playing the Dark Urge, there is one reference that I was so surprised, and I was like, oh, this is amazing.
Damn. Okay, I just started a Dark Urge playthrough that I'm going to have to play very slowly, but I'll be on the lookout.
Yeah, it's a fantastic thing. And like you said, if you don't enjoy the combat, you can play on story mode. It's not a problem.
Yeah.
If you enjoy the combat, get a mod called Stratagems of the Sword Coast.
Okay.
Because it's going to make everything much more challenging. And I have to say, Baldur's Gate 2, to this day, still has the best mage battles in any RPG ever. Mm. When you're just like casting a bunch of like spells of protection and dispelling the enemy and seeing hearing the sound of what the enemy mage is casting. He's like, Vita, Mortis, Kareo. And you're he's casting necromancy. This is going to be a finger death. I have to protect from that. I think never an RPG made Magic combat so much fun as Baldur's Gate 2. Mm-hmm. So really, like, put a mod that helps. If you enjoy that, put Stratagems of the Sword Coast to really, like, pull it an extra level. It's a fantastic experience.
Nice, nice. What's your pick for the 2000s?
Mine will be going to be Neverwinter Nights 2, specifically the Mask of the Betrayer expansion.
Okay.
Which is like, this is, in a sense, this is the New Vegas of Neverwinter Nights.
Okay.
The same way that, like, Obsidian got Fallout 3 and did New Vegas, this is Obsidian getting Neverwinter Nights and doing Mask of the Betrayer, which is basically, in a lot of ways, the closest we ever got to Planescape Torment 2. Which is very high praise, I know. Neverwinter Nights 2 has the problem that, like, the engine is very clunky. Mm-hmm. The biggest issue is the camera. The camera in the game is, like, atrocious. Most of the time, you're going to, like, spend, like, looking at the ceiling or, like, looking at the floor. Uh-huh. But in terms of gameplay, it has, like, all the classes of D&D that you can expect. Like, you can play all the crazy combinations. Mm-hmm. And the story is really interesting. It goes, like, for the kind of, like, Planescape Torment vibe, where you have a curse, where you have, like, to consume souls or you're going to die. And because of this, you're going to travel across the plains as well and meet a bunch of really unique companions, from, like, a spirit animal to, like, a devouring demon and stuff like this. And recruit everyone to your party, because that's the cool thing to do. Mm-hmm. So it's really, like, a... It's kind of tricky to play in a sense of, like, the camera and is a bit janky. After, like, 1-2 hours, you'll get used to it. It never feels great, the controls, but the story is just, like, so good. The story, the plot, the combat is just, like, so interesting. It's really, like, I think, a kind of forgotten gem. I specifically, for the CRPG book, I made a separate entry for it. I didn't want to do, like, oh, Neverwinter Nights and also the expansions.
Right.
I put a separate entry because, like, everyone who played this game really loves it. Mm. You can start, like, from the base campaign of Neverwinter Nights 2, which is not, like, amazing, but is, like, good enough. And then you go into Mask of the Betrayer, which continues that story. And it's just, like, a fantastic experience.
Awesome. Awesome. Love to hear it. That's a, like, Obsidian. I didn't know Obsidian did that. So that's cool. And the Fallout New Vegas analogy is, sounds good to me. Moving into the 2010s, I picked Shadowrun Dragonfall, which we've talked about already. But the reason I picked Shadowrun Dragonfall, as we're starting to get more into my wheelhouse here, the reason I picked this is because for someone who liked Baldur's Gate 3, one of the reasons you probably liked it is because you probably liked the characters and dealing with their backstories, learning about what happened, and then doing the quests to help them along in their own stories, independent or kind of, you know, on the side of the main story. And Shadowrun Dragonfall has one of my favorite groups of side characters of any RPG I've played. They all have really interesting backstories, and by the time you get them, like, a lot of them are in kind of rough situations, similar to some of the characters, well, actually, most of them in Baldur's Gate 3 they're pretty fucked by the time you meet them. Dragonfall's pretty similar, and I just thought that the writing of those quests, the way that you kind of earn their trust over time and then get to go on those side missions is something that is a direct comparison. Also, like, turn-based combat that I think is pretty damn fun in the Shadowrun RPGs, the more recent ones. I should go back and play the old console ones more. But anyway, Shadowrun Dragonfall, that's my pick.
Yeah, it's a great game that, like, honestly, I overlooked when it came out, because the first Shadowrun game didn't give me, like, a good image. It was originally made to be, like, a mobile game. Mm. And you can feel some of that on the UI, especially. Like, it feels like a very, like, small-scale game sometimes. Mm-hmm. But they did so much good with that small scale, like, especially Dragonfall, really, like, is an amazing game. And I really like the setting as well. It's very interesting, like, all the cyberpunk. I think it, in many ways, it's a cyberpunk better than Cyberpunk 2077. Mm.
And Shadowrun Hong Kong is good too. It's just, it's like saying if you love Shadowrun Dragonfall, you will also love Shadowrun Hong Kong. Like, they're both really good. All right, what's your pick for the 2010s?
So for the 2010s, I'm going to go on the exact opposite of this.
Yes.
I'm going to go for Dragon's Dogma Dark Arisen.
Hell yeah.
Which is like top 10 RPGs of my life. I really love this game, and I think I'm really happy we're getting the second one.
Mm-hmm.
Because people simply don't get this game. Yes, it has the amazing combat that people talk a lot about. And it's really cool that, like, you can grapple any enemy. You can, you know, you're fighting a griffon. You can grab on him. He's going to fly around trying to shake you off. You mm-hmm. hit him. He falls on the ground. Like, fantastic combat. But one thing that people don't talk much about it, that is actually, like, very hidden inside the game, is the amount of reactivity it has to the choices that you make, like, organically. So it's not a game that's going to do that very Western RPG thing of like, oh, there's two people fighting, and it's going to pop up a menu like, do you want to help person A or person B?
Yeah.
And then depending on that, you play a cutscene. Everything is done organically. So if you have two people fighting, they're going to fight each out. And whoever wins, if you interfere or you don't interfere, that's going to change the story. And that is like, everything is like organically. Sometimes, like, maybe it's they do back roll, person A or person B is going to win, like in this simple example. And you can go and, like, if you watch them fight, it's going to play one way. You can go and attack one. You can go and heal the other. If one dies, like, they're having like an honor duel and one person gets killed, you can go and resurrect the person after the combat. And the person is going to say, oh, thank you for resurrecting, but I lost my honor, so I'm going to have to leave the country.
Oh.
So this kind of reactivity that, like, you expect, you don't expect in Japanese RPGs, and we praise so much in Baldur's Gate, is already in Dragon's Dogma.
Nice.
It's
nice.
Just like the game never tells you about this. So there's a bunch of things that, like, let's say, if you go to the castle at night and you visit this tower, the door will be unlocked, and then you can see this cutscene that explains a whole different story and gives you a side quest that you will never have.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing of this has any quest markers, has any like quest journal explaining to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like a very reactive world for you to live inside of it. And it's such like a wonderful experience. Like, if you play this game once and you still don't understand what I'm talking about, if you play the second time, you're going to see a completely different experience. And you're just like, what have I done differently?
Mm.
And it's just like so interesting how they did this. And I really hope that they do the same again on Dragon's Dogma 2.
Yeah.
But this time they tell people.
Yeah.
Because honestly, I saw so many reviews that say like, oh, this is a great RPG. It's such a shame that it's linear. And like, this is not a linear RPG.
Mm.
You get things like a quest to go to the forest and save this character. If you take like too long, the quest will completely change and the outcome of the quest is completely different, and you will lose like one potential seller with a bunch of items. Like, there's so many options and reactivity in this game. It's just like, it's hidden.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really a fantastic game.
I didn't even know that. I played Dragon's Dogma. I love it. It's but I didn't know that about it. Probably because, like you said, it's very hidden. Fun fact, Dragon's Dogma is the most popular episode of this podcast ever made. So people who like Dragon's Dogma, you know?
If you get the full, you remember there is a quest where you have to get a ring for the king, right?
Uh-huh.
Which is this really amazing ring full of powers.
Mm-hmm.
Most people just, oh, I got a quest to give the ring to the king. Most people just give them back.
Yeah.
You can actually go to the city. And there's an NPC there that makes copies, forgeries of items.
Yeah.
You can give the king the ring to them. They will make a copy. And then you can give the forgery to the king. The king will say, oh, the ring lost its power, but maybe this is like normal because it's too old. And you keep the ring with all those superpowers for yourself.
Nice.
None of this is mentioned by any NPC in the game.
Right.
Mm. They will react to you if you do this, but no one will tell you do that. It's it's really like a... In a sense, it's kind of like the Dark Souls logic of like, I'm not telling you, like, go explore, go find the lore.
Yeah.
But they did this for the quests, which is something like, I don't know any other RPG that is so, maybe like Morrowind with things like finding the cure for vampirism and stuff like this. maybe that's the closest to like an unmarked quest, but Dragon's Dogma does that's like 20 times more.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I am even more excited for the sequel now, more than I already was. My pick for the 2020s, I'm going to make it kind of quick. I've already mentioned it. Disco Elysium's my pick, and it's kind of cheating, but the final cut came out in 2021. So we're using it there, and it's my podcast. You can file your complaints at patreon.com/realDaveJackson. Disco Elysium is one of my favorite games ever made, so when I have the chance to recommend it, I'm going to do it. I love the story in it, of course. I love the writing. I love the characters. But what I love about it is...
communism.
The main thing, yeah. What I love about it is the different take on using tabletop mechanics that you understand, like dice and like skills, etc., but using those things for a narrative purpose in a way that I haven't seen any other game do, basically. Your skills don't act like skills in other RPGs. Your checks that you roll are a little bit different. They're pretty interesting. The way that you can use your clothing to influence how you're able to do things. But all of this without worrying about combat at all. So many RPGs are like, I picked up a new armor piece. I am most worried about how much armor it gives me above any other characteristic that it might have. Disco Elysium doesn't have combat, so that's out of the equation whatsoever, like entirely. And you kind of have like some physical skills that you might use in a violent situation, but it doesn't have a combat system like a game traditionally would. So the way that they implement tabletop mechanics into something that doesn't have to be concerned with combat, all tying into this really awesome story about a person who's trying to put their life and their mind back together. If you want to, you don't have to do that. If you don't want to, you can go full Tequila Sunrise if you want. But yeah, that's my pick. One of my favorite games ever. So obviously going to be my pick.
I completely agree with you. It's like one of the best RPGs ever made, not only because how good it is, but also for how, like you said, it doesn't have combat. I think in a way, it blew open the doors for the genre. Mm-hmm. It's not the first RPG to do this, but it's the first one that was so successful that I think like we're still going to see the repercussions of this, of people going like, okay, now I can make like really cool RPGs.
Yeah,
that don't focus on this. We got like Citizen Sleeper, of course.
Yes.
But I think we're going to see more and more of this, which is great because like we have so many RPGs that are focused on combat. We should have also some that are not.
Right. And your game that you wrote down for the 2020s, I was very happy to see because it's a super interesting game. So tell everybody about it.
Yeah. So my pick for the 2020s is Wilder Myth, which is like, it's a very weird game to get into because yeah. Like the min-max part of me, the moment I start playing the game, I was like, oh, this is a tactical RPG. And like, it's really cute and everything. And like, why can't move my items around. I start to get like really angry with the game when I first start playing it. Like, why can I not give like the sword to the other character? And but then when you get it, what the game is trying to do is mm-hmm. really amazing because the whole focus of the game is not being just a tactical RPG. It is focused on telling stories dynamically based on the choices and the events that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So small things like, for example, oh, you gave this character a sword. He's now the sword character. This is his sword. This is his weapon. Everything is about tied to the character. So if he gets hurt in combat, that might affect his story. He might get like a scar. He might get scared of combat or something like this. Outside of combat, you will get like some story choices. So let's say maybe you're going to investigate a cursed temple and you're going to find an item. If you steal the item, now you have a really powerful sword, but also the gods curse you. And now you have like, let's say, a rat's tail because it's a curse of the gods and this gives you a penalty. And as you keep playing, the stories pile up, time passes on, your characters build relationships between them. And it just, every single playthrough that you make, you create an entire different story with a whole lineage of things like that hero character that you start making, that you're like, oh, this is my character. Now he's old and he died and he passed away, and your other character is going to inherit the magical sword that he got from the Troll Cavern. You know, it just builds this whole narrative, this whole story. Like we were talking about in tabletop RPGs, it's not about the story that the game presents to you being good or bad. It's mostly like, oh, evil invasion of evil monsters. You have to stop it. What's important about the game is what your characters are going through and the story that is being generated by this. If you're being good, if you're being bad, what you want to do with the resources that you have is really like a one-of-a-kind RPG that combines really good tactical RPG with this whole thing about choices, consequence, and creating your own organic kind of story.
Yeah, absolutely. That kind of feeling that like anything can really happen and the game is just going to keep going with it, and that becomes your story, and then that becomes like your ancestor's story, and then that becomes legend as you keep playing and playing, is really, really interesting. And it's like, it's procedural generated story, but it's still entertaining. And like, it never felt like, oh yeah, this doesn't have the human touch to it or anything like that. Like, it felt really good to have that be your story as you play. And the combat's really fun too. I really like the combat. It has some really creative magic that I've really never seen in other stories, like not just games, but any story that uses magic. A cool system.
Yeah, and they are very good at making the scenarios as well, because it's not a game that has a lot of trash combat. Every battle is kind of meaningful, not only because maybe it is a story battle that's going to have like very big consequences, but maybe sometimes you're just like exploring a village, and in other RPGs, it will be like trash combat. It's just like, oh, you're fighting three goblins, but maybe one of them is going to infect you, and that's going to make your character get poisoned. He might recover, but now he has like, let's say, a bad arm and he cannot use two-handed weapons. You know, every single thing that you do in this game matters and is going to impact the story, and I think is really a one-of-a-kind RPG.
Absolutely, yeah. All right, so with all those RPGs being recommended and that little history lesson we had at the beginning, it's time to talk about the CRPG Book Project, which I mentioned at the top is a wonderful resource full of CRPG history, kind of a walk through the history of the genre, but also like individual entries for any game that anyone might think is important through the years. There are over 450 games in there. Each game gets a dedicated section with history, screenshots, a mini review, the review talking about the game itself, but also talking about its place in CRPG history, maybe some things that it introduced, or like, you know, like DNA that was passed on to later games in the genre. And then some even have mods that are recommended for people who want to try them out for the first time. So I saw the inspiration list on RPG Codex. I was happy to see Planescape Torment as number one on the list. I saw that and I was like, yeah, that makes sense. But what inspired you to take this from, you know, a collection of votes on a forum and turn it into this huge project?
So the whole thing is like, it wasn't huge when it began.
Yeah.
Like you said, like we made a voting on the RPG Codex to get like the top. First it was the 50, then it was a 72, then it became like 101 top RPGs of all time.
Because you can't stop, yeah.
Yeah, and that is the whole thing. Like we did that vote and we're like, oh, please everyone like explain. Like you're saying to me that I really should play Gothic 2. Why? So we asked people to write a little short paragraph explaining why. And of course, people didn't write one short paragraph. They write like a whole page of text why this is the best game ever.
Yeah.
So we'll have like, instead of like 50 games with a short paragraph, we'll have like 100 games with one page of text for each of them. And then I was like, this is really good content. I should turn this into a book. And just like to be clear about this, the book is free,
yeah.
Like the PDF version, because it's like the collaborative work of so many people. I edit it together, but the book is free. I don't make any money from it. You can download the PDF from the website. And if you buy the hardcover version from Bitmap Books, all the earnings from it goes to a charity. So like it's a completely non-commercial project.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I saw all that content, I was like, okay, how can we make this into a book? Because in my mind, I was like, oh, I have like 75% of a book already. I just need to put like a little extra. And then I began, okay, I need to put the historically important games.
Yeah.
So let's say the book has Ultima 7. The forum post has Ultima 7. I should put Ultima, all the other Ultimas as well.
Uh-huh.
That's already like 10 new games.
Yeah, yeah.
If you put two pages to each of them, is 20 pages of text. And then you add every Wizardry game, every Might and Magic game. You add Diablo 1 and 2 because the Codex doesn't like Diablo, so they didn't put on the list. And of course,
yeah.
You have to put that game. And then you think like, oh, I should put the Bard's Tale as well. It just keeps going. And as you are exploring, which is why the book had two editions. The first edition was, let's say, like the gamer edition of what usually us, like in the West, talking about RPGs will see as the timeline of RPGs. It's mm-hmm. Ultima and everything. Wizardry, you go into Might and Magic, Fallout, Baldur's Gate, Mass Effect. Then people from other countries started reaching me out. So the way I found about Chinese RPGs was a Chinese guy emailed me and said like, oh, you should talk about these RPGs as well.
Hmm.
And I start checking them and I found this, oh, actually, in the 90s and the early 2000s, between China and Taiwan, you had over 300 PC RPGs of like really high quality, inspired by things that we don't have, like Wuxia stories and folklore from the land. And you're like, we never talk about this. How can I make a book about RPG history that doesn't mention those?
Mm-hmm.
And then you found the Korean ones. Oh, the Koreans also had like their whole scene with like a bunch of saga like War of Genesis, which for them is like the Final Fantasy of Korea. Like, I have to put that on the book as well.
Yeah.
It just keeps going. Like, then you find out Iran also has like a legendary RPG. Like, have you played Children of Morta?
Oh, Children of Morta. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That game is made by Iranian developers
mm-hmm.
who had to start making this this game, Iranian CRPG from like the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
There's like Age of Pavilions,
yeah.
Like Age of Heroes. Like, they had to start this. Like, the game that you play on Steam is from Iranian people that started in the industry with this game. How can I say this is not important? So I have to put it on the book.
Right.
And it just keeps going, you know, like Russia has its own scenes of RPGs that goes like from a bunch of games that were only released there, but like were extremely influential. So you have to add them too. And it just keeps going. That's why it has almost 700 pages.
Yeah.
And still to this day, I keep finding things like the last update that I did to the book, we had already like printed the hardcover version. So this is the only game that like is not on the hardcover version, but is on the PDF,
mm-hmm.
which is the Anito, which is a game from the Philippines. It okay. was the first PC commercial PC game from the Philippines. And the guys did a CRPG based on colonial history. And it's like, it's such a cool game. It's such a cool idea. The visuals are completely unique. And like, I have to put this on the book.
Yeah.
So it just keeps going, you know, that's why I'm not updating anymore because like it will be impossible to handle. Like the game goes into 2019.
Yeah.
It ends with Disco Elysium, which I think is a very nice like mm-hmm. bow tie to put at the end of, but today will be impossible. Like there's so many, like I could make a book the same size just of RPGs that came out between 2019 and now.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really, really interested when I first picked up, well, when I first started reading the PDF and eventually bought the physical book, really interested in the early history, the stuff that I'd never heard about, the stuff from the 70s and stuff like that, but also those things from other countries. Like I used to live in South Korea, but nobody, at least like the students that I teach, were not interested in RPGs. Like they're interested in the popular stuff of today. So when I was reading about that, you had me like texting my friends in Korea and being like, hey, can you help me find the War of Genesis 2 so I can play this? Like, and freshen up on my Korean language and stuff too. But I love the inclusion of that stuff in the book. And that's, you know, we're running up against time and not able to spend as much time on the book as I would have liked to. But one of my favorite things about the project is how comprehensive it is. And it's not just like, you know, here's kind of like you said, the list from the forum, which is here are the favorites. And then that's it. That's the history of CRPGs. Like, it's so much more comprehensive than that. And it's something I really appreciate, because I don't know, if you're as into it as I am, and as you obviously are, then this is all interesting stuff and worth reading and learning about, that, you know, I really recommend. And if you're just interested in the history of games from Korea or China or something like that, Felipe has wonderful posts on Medium about that stuff too. But the book, whether you want to buy the physical one or just read the free PDF, is like super worth your time. It's a great resource if you want to learn about a game, but it's also just fun to open it up and read about something I'd never heard about.
Yeah, thank you for the shout out. And like the articles that you mentioned about like Chinese and Korean games, I edited and updated on the book. So yeah. I would recommend, just even if you just want to read those articles, to just get the PDF of the book, mm-hmm. and go to the end, because it has like the updated version with screenshots and everything.
Yeah. One question for you, because the book project is a collaboration with lots of people, like over 100 people contributed articles about the games to the book. But you also wrote several of them too. Do you know how many of them you wrote for it?
I wrote about, I think, 40% of the book, more
or
less.
Yeah.
Because the whole thing is that like people are very passionate about certain games. So like, if you say, who wants to write about Fallout 1 or Dragon Age? It's like 100 people. But then if you go like, who wants to talk about, let's say, Alien Fires, which is an Amiga game, an Amiga dungeon crawler that is really unique because the dungeons, it's not like usually like the square grid. It has odd angles. So like, it's not like 90 degrees. It could be like 32 degrees and the other one is 67 degrees, the walls. And every single NPC talks to you using the Amiga text-to-voice pattern.
Okay.
So like, it's a complete historical artifact, a curiosity. Is a very bad game, but it's such an interesting and cool game that I was like, oh, I need to write about this game. And of course, like, I had to write that review because there's like 5 people alive who played that game.
Yeah.
But I really wanted. So usually that's how it goes. Like for the big games, especially the ones that have like complete complex modding scenes, like I cannot talk about, let's say, Neverwinter Nights. So I got a modder who like did a lot of mods and was like one of a respected member of the modding community to write about the mods for Neverwinter Nights. Those I usually get like, let's say, high profile people within the community. So like for Jagged Alliance 2, I got one of the admins of the Bear's Pit, which is like a forum that focus only on Jagged Alliance. And what I did was the weird games, you know, the ones that no one wants to talk about, or the ones that like no one plays, but they're still very interesting. So those are the ones that I cover. And I also cover Fallout 1 because it's my favorite. So I was like, okay, this one is mine.
At the end of the day, it's your project. So you can stake out that one. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, it's your podcast. It's my book. I'm like, okay, Fallout 1 is mine.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really cool project and highly recommended for, you know, if anyone has listened this far in this podcast, you like RPGs or you just like the two of us, why not go check out the book?
Yeah, and it's free.
Yeah, it's free. And if you are inclined, if you like physical books, the physical version from Bitmap Books is really, really high quality stuff. I have it sitting on the table next to me. I pick it up and flip through it from time to time, looking at, you know, just some cool game I want to learn about. But really high quality stuff. And as Felipe said, all proceeds go to charity. So a worthwhile cause as well. I will not take up any more of your time. We've been here, I think we're probably over time at this point. But Felipe, I really appreciate you taking this time to come on and talk RPGs with me. This has been awesome.
Oh yeah, also been awesome to me. Thank you so much for inviting me and for all the praises for the book.
Yeah, of course. And if anyone's listening, they can look down in the show notes for this episode. You'll find a link to the book project. You'll find a link for the Bitmap store for the physical version of the book. And we'll also link Felipe's Twitter account down there too. So go check all of that stuff out. Very worthwhile. If you would like to support this show, the same plugs as always. Ratings and reviews on your favorite podcast platform really help so that people can find the show. You can join the Discord server where we will hopefully have a lot of RPG discussion going on this week. Baldur's Gate 3 episode is also coming up. So if you want to come in and talk about that game, the Discord server is a great place to do it. There is a link down in the show notes where you can join. And also patreon.com/realDaveJackson is the place if you want to support monetarily. Also have another show that you might like. It's called A Top 3 Podcast, where we do top 3 lists. And a little tease, some of the things that we've talked about today have been mentioned on that show. We did top 3 video game sidekicks, and I talked about Mort from Planescape Torment in that episode, because he's very memorable.
I hope you also put the Disco Elysium King there.
Oh, yeah. Kim was probably number one. Yeah, that was a long time ago, but yeah. So that is all for us. Thanks again to Felipe for joining. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the end. Tune in next week for the next game to come out of the backlog.